Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
When they have that revelation,
it's making sure
that maybe looking at this case, it could be an interesting process piece.
Okay.
From One World Trade Center in Manhattan, this is the New Yorker Radio Hour, a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker.
Driving the car. Getting into my car, I vow that I will drive with mindful care and caution. If, in fact, this is my vehicle, for I often step into someone else's car by accident. If I have done so now, here in the parking lot of Stop and Shop, may I smile with self-compassion and not curse my cluelessness, as the cars where I live are all Subarus, and all the same model, and all the same jasmine green. A bewildering forest of foresters.
Welcome to the New Yorker Radio Hour. And now, poetry for modern mindfulness.
Going to the movies. Taking my seat in the movie theater, I am excited to be here and offer my heartfelt hope that it is not a film like Carol, beautiful but so boring. I love the period costumes, but wearied of the endless shots of the movie stars gazing soulfully at each other or staring into space like mute people. I love talking to you, one of the women says to the other in one scene, which is strange because they hardly talked at all. May this be a movie with more dialogue and fewer close-ups and way better sex scenes. At the workplace. Today, I vow to regard my coworkers serenely, with loving kindness and without judgment. This one, who appears not to bathe and has a pungent odor. That one, who leads the email clique trash-talking the rest of us. Are merely creatures caught in DUCA, or suffering. May they one day be made whole and not so messed up, or at least be transferred to another department.
Poetry for Modern Mindfulness by the writer and performer Jenny Allen. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour, and I'm David Remnick. Thanks for joining me. If this was re-entry week for you, for school, for work, I hope you survived it. Now, back to business.
Please welcome Kareem Abdul-Jabbar.
At the Democratic National Convention this summer, the towering vision of Kareem Abdul-Jabbar took to the stage and lent his support to the Democratic Party and its nominee.
I'm Michael Jordan, and I'm here with Hillary. I said that because I know that Donald Trump couldn't tell the difference.
Michael Jordan aside, and forget LeBron James and Steph Curry, Kareem Abdul-Jabbar is still arguably the most dominant player in the history of college and professional basketball. In 20 years with the NBA, he became the all-time leading scorer, and since he retired in 1989, nobody has broken his record, not even MJ. But Abdul-Jabbar's so-called retirement has also been kind of remarkable in its way. He set his mind to becoming a writer. He's the author of books ranging from memoir to African-American history to a kind of Sherlock Holmes reboot called Mycroft Holmes. His latest book is called Writings on the Wall, Searching for a New Equality Beyond Black and White. The essays share his ideas of right and wrong, his love of history, and recently he told me why he chose this year to appear at a political convention for the very first time.
Well, I've been invited before, but I never really had the inclination to go. And I wanted to go this year because I thought that whatever happens in this election will be very important for our country. And I wanted to take part and, you know, say whatever it was that I had to say.
You didn't feel that way before?
No, I didn't. I didn't think it was that crucial. But given all of the manifestations of racism and xenophobia, and just a whole lot of tension and hatred going back and forth, I felt that this year is crucial.
Why do you think this is going on now? We've gone through now, and maybe it's because of the advent of videotape and iPhones, because these incidents have been going on, God knows, for decades. But why do you think these police shootings, these manifestations of racism and xenophobia have come to this fever pitch in the last X months?
Well, I think that a lot of people are noticing a change in our country. We have a black president. More and more of the population are people of color. Seeing that change taking place and not being able to do anything has made a lot of people uptight. And I think Donald Trump recognized that and decided to take advantage of it.
As the world existed in 1967-68 and in the wake of Muhammad Ali's refusal to serve in the military, you decided not to participate in the Olympic Games.
Right.
The Olympic Games just finished. Would you have played in the Olympics as the world is now in 2016, do you think?
I probably would have. You know, there was a lot less incentive for me to forego the Olympics in years subsequent to 1968.
What kind of price did you pay for not playing in the Olympics?
Well, I got criticized a lot, but fortunately for me, I had another year of college ball to play, and the American basketball team won the gold medal in 1968, so nobody can blame me on the fact that they didn't win, and I just moved on.
Now, in your book, you try to come to grips with and begin a chapter with a wonderful quote from James Baldwin: "The most dangerous creation of any society is that man who has nothing to lose." You grew up in Inwood.
Yep.
And Inwood is by far not the poorest place in New York City, but you're cheek by jowl with it. You grew up aware of poverty and people with nothing to lose.
Yeah.
What is your sense of things now when you go back to your old neighborhood, when you go back, when you were in the inner city in L.A. or New York or anywhere else, that there are more people with nothing to lose than when you started out?
Well, I think it's unfortunate because America was going in the other direction. And I think that...
In a positive direction.
In a positive direction. And I think that we become too comfortable with mediocrity. American school kids now no longer lead the world in most academic disciplines. And that was the case for the longest time. And I think that's a direct failure of our school system. And our school system is failing because we don't want to spend the money to pay the teachers to do the great job that they did for so long. All of a sudden, it's okay that, people aren't given the opportunity to get a first-rate education and go on to college. It's these kind of issues that really bother me, and it's what I'm talking about in my book.
In the opening of the new book, you write about being a black role model, about the frustration in, quote, knowing that although you are proof it can be done, like a happy lottery winner waving a million-dollar ticket, the odds are so astronomically against others that it sometimes feels as if you're more the source of false hope and crushed dreams.
That is a problem, you know, because black Americans who are able to overcome the odds and do well and be successful, people point to them as an example as to, well, why aren't all black people that successful?
Did you carry that heavily when you came into prominence, which was really early? I remember, you know, as a kid hearing about you, even as a high school player. Did you carry that weight very heavily?
I didn't carry it at all. I was going to do the best I could do, no matter what. I got to give my grandmother credit for that. You know, she was very much an advocate for education and discipline. And she felt that if you got an education and had some discipline, you could achieve anything. And I have to agree with her.
So at no point in college or as a pro player did you feel the burden of being a role model? You just felt the burden of doing your best as a ball player.
Yeah, doing my best and maintaining my grades, getting out of school, That was very important to me.
I want to get a sense of how you think about contemporary athletics today. You raised the question of paying college athletes. Nowhere in the world that I know of, nowhere, is college athletics what it is in the United States, either as a business or as an obsession. You go to Europe and start talking about, you know, the Fighting Gamecocks of this one or the Spartans of here. They just have no idea what you're talking about. Here you think the system ought to be changed radically.
Well, I think that the people who perform, the college athletes who perform, they're exploited. College athletics generates billions of dollars in revenue, and the college athletes don't get to share in that. People that run the NCAA have $1 million salaries. Really,
to say nothing of the coaches.
Oh, the coaches are doing great. So I think that that's wrong, and some of that incredible amount of money should go to the athletes just to make their lives easier. I'm not saying that they have to be made wealthy, but they should not have to worry about insurance. They should not have to worry about getting hurt and losing their scholarship.
That argument comes up against the traditional argument of you would lose the amateur experience, you would lose the college experience. You think that's a kind of construction of hypocrisy?
Of course it's hypocritical. If the amateur experience was supposed to be so important, why aren't the coaches participating in it?
Yeah.
They're taking home millions of dollars a year.
In salary and in sneaker contracts and all the rest.
Contracts, all of those things, they're doing great. The athletes, if you get hurt and can't play again.
That's it.
That's it. And that's a terrible example of exploiting someone.
Did you feel this way when you were 18, 19 years old?
Yeah, I did.
Hmm.
And that's because, you know, one of the people that I got to know at UCLA explained it to me. He said.
Who was that?
His name was Sam Gilbert. He was a businessman who befriended me. He scalped my tickets, which enabled me to have a few coins in my pocket.
Now, if you had gotten caught for him scalping your tickets, you would have gotten in hot water, no?
I might have, yeah.
Yeah.
And he didn't care. You know, he felt that we should get some type of compensation for what we were doing. And we were winning the NCAA every year. If you make it possible for the athletes to have a car and be able to take their girl out every so often, I think it would be a lot different, and the complaint wouldn't be so extreme.
Now, I wonder, are you a football fan?
Yes.
Do you have any problems with football? You watch football, you now know even more than we ever have.
Concussion system.
Concussions and people who play even a modestly long career can barely get out of a chair, a lot of them.
I know a lot of those guys. A number of my friends that play professional football are dead. A couple of them died this year, you know.
Who's that?
Ken Stabler.
Mm-hmm.
Jack Tatum's dead. A lot of guys on the Raiders, I knew. But John Matuszak, he was a big fan of mine when I was in Milwaukee. And then, you know, he went to Iowa and then played for the Raiders. To see these guys die like that, I think those guys didn't understand what they were doing to themselves. Now that they have an understanding of it.
What can be done? Is football a fixable sport?
I don't know if it is, because I think the concussions are inevitable.
Because what occurs to me is that pro football, all NBA to the side and pop music to the side, pro football is probably the most popular entertainment in the United States. Certainly the Super Bowl is the highest rated of anything. And if pro football is unfixable in medical terms, you're going to start seeing more and more kids not playing it. In the same way that boxing became a kind of marginal part of American pop culture, that pro football and college football may one day not exist.
Well, I'm sure if it doesn't exist in the future, it'll be for good reasons.
Is there too much money at stake, do you think, for it to be fixed?
I think the money is going to make it a lot harder to fix. But what they've learned about the concussion issue, I think, really will make it at least a little bit more humane.
I read a pretty scary article in ESPN magazine in which Larry Bird was talking about the health issues that come to men of a certain height. I think a number of former NBA centers have died in the last several years.
Nate Thurman, Daryl Dawkins, Moses Malone. I could go on.
And what does that tell you? What, when you talk to doctors, what is that all about?
I think a lot of it has to do with the fact that a lot of guys, once they've stopped their professional career, they stop going to see doctors and don't see these things creeping up on them.
Because athletes think of themselves as so perfectly
attuned to everything and able to perform at a higher level, so their health must be okay.
Did you relish retirement or did you fear it? Was it a difficult transition?
I kind of relished retirement. It gave me a chance to get close to my children and getting over the burnout. That took me about 3 or 4 years. Then I got interested in writing again and realized that I had to do something for
a
the rest
crazy
of my
obsession,
life.
Writing.
Yeah, but it's fun. And I wanted to do it.
Is there anything as satisfying, after you retired, is there anything that can match athletic either achievement or triumph?
I think there probably are things that can match it, but it's really tough. It's great, and the whole nation watches you, and you have fans and friends all over the country.
But that's something that always seemed you had a certain ambivalence about, the whole nation watching you.
Yeah, I did. I wanted the opportunity to excel, but I also felt that it was also a lot of pressure. But, I was able to handle the pressure and do well.
I'll say so. Kareem, thank you very much.
Well, it's been great talking with you.
Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, writer and master of the skyhook. His new book, co-authored by Raymond Obstfeld, is called Writings on the Wall. You're listening to the New Yorker Radio Hour. Coming up this hour, a cinematographer makes a movie about herself. And Ariel Levy, volunteer psychedelics reporter, talks about taking drugs on the job. But it's okay, because I don't think the experience was all that much fun.
This girl leans over and lets loose the Victoria Falls of vomit all over me. All over me. I am covered.
You'll want to stick around for that.
Vomit.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
There are four questions Jews ask to mark Passover every year. This Passover is leading many of us to ask more questions, once tied to our identity as Jewish Americans. I'm Matt Katz, and on the next Notes from America, we'll talk about hard conversations happening in Jewish communities right now, how we can heal our divisions, and why this Passover feels different. Available wherever you get podcasts.
Welcome back to the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. Kirsten Johnson is a filmmaker and cinematographer who specializes in documentaries with a distinctly left-leaning politics. She's worked on Citizen Four, the film about Edward Snowden, and Michael Moore's Fahrenheit 9/11. Her latest project is something very, very different. It's much more personal, and it's called Camera Person. It's about her, about Kirsten Johnson, and she met up with Tad Friend, a staff writer at the magazine. Tad, so you spent some time together with her recently. What did you do?
I did. We went out on the East River Ferry on an extremely hot afternoon. And she spent a fair amount of time complaining about how hot it was in a very cheerful way. She's quite tall. She's nearly 6'2", and she's sort of appealingly clumsy, as she acknowledges. And she manages to somehow see, you know, what's going on around you. And I felt it was great to go with her just as, you know, someone who also was interested in trying to figure out groups of people or individuals, and to sort of look, try to borrow her eye in a sense and see how she frames things and where she looks to catch a moment or a scene or a dynamic. And it was really sort of professionally interesting, as well as the fact that I just liked her company because she's totally charming.
Tell me about the film.
The film is sort of an amazing collection of outtakes from the movies she's made over the years, many of them having to do with massacres and genocide, which sounds very depressing. But then they're intermixed with very personal film. She's sort of home movies, actually. She took it home with her mother, who has Alzheimer's, kind of looking over her shoulder and seeming surprised and bewildered by who this person is with a camera and why she's filming her.
Does the film begin to make any narrative sense at all?
It makes a narrative sense in the sense that you begin to weave together in your own head a narration of who this cinematographer is. I think when we're watching documentaries, we rarely think about, you know, who shot this film and does she eat yogurt and does she have a dog or a cat? You know, you just are interested in the people in the frame. But the way in which it's shot suddenly makes you very curious about who she is, and you begin to feel like the intense human connection that she has with the people she's seeing, and her sense of curiosity and warmth. And her camera becomes almost like an infrared camera, really. Hmm. It follows people around, and you sense that she has an instinct for who the person is who is most alive at any given moment in the frame.
So I like that.
Right. Yeah. So one thing I was curious about is, like,
sorry.
Do you feel like when you said earlier you were looking for shots?
Yeah.
Like, is it just a sort of instinctive thing? Oh, that's a shot. What elements do you need to be present for you to think that's a shot?
Well, I mean, a lot of times it's just what I'm attracted to. Like, he's gone now, but there was a man who had these amazing jeans that were all shades of blue and very strange. And there was something happening with the interaction between his pants, these blue seats, the sky, that just told a story of blue to me that I wanted to film. And it had nothing to do with my, you know, mission.
Well, and that's one of the things actually I really loved about the film was how I think of a film as visual, but actually I felt like in this movie you got a sense of emotionally what it was like to be that person, whoever it was. You're clearly, like, you know, not just there to shoot this person from a neutral standpoint, but to say, you know, I have a camera, but I'm here, we're having a human interaction.
Yeah, and I think the other thing, a lot of times pointing a camera at a person, you know, we can say it gives them a voice or gives them a chance to speak, but a lot of times I think it can feel really isolating to be alone on the other side of a camera. So, you know, that's the kind of thing that never makes it into movies, the things that you're saying to people to try to, you know, help somebody feel better in a moment when they feel terrible, basically. Right. Yeah.
The moment in the film, there are many, but the one that particularly comes to mind is when you're talking to someone who's getting an abortion in Alabama.
Yeah.
And I think, I believe it's you who says that we've all had unplanned pregnancies.
I don't really think I can do a second child not by myself. And that's why I just feel like a bad person, a bad female, because I let it happen a second time. And I told myself not to do it, but it happened anyways.
The only rule I'm going to give you is you may not say I'm not a good person anymore, because that is not the case. Mm-hmm. An unintended pregnancy is an unintended pregnancy. That's all it is. That's all it is. So, no more.
Okay.
Okay? I'm not kidding.
Yeah, me too. I support her.
Make us all cry. And it makes everybody cry,
and it's also,
number one.
And it's also happened to all of us.
Yeah.
We've all had unintended pregnancies.
So she's not a cinematographer. She's not a filmmaker who wants to hide. She's like Dion Arbus, who wanted her subjects to be engaged with her in some way.
I think in this movie you get that sense, but as I said, many of the shots were outtakes from other directors' movies, but she makes them the centerpiece of her film, and you feel like in her film, yes, she absolutely wants to connect with the audience. And when you finally see a glimpse of her in the mirror near the end, it's incredibly moving, like, because you think you're seeing a glimpse of her in the mirror as her mother, who has Alzheimer's, is brushing her hair on camera, and then her mother is not quite sure who this person is, but she knows she should be tender toward her, and we feel the same way.
Who's this guy?
Who's that guy?
That's who I married.
That's who you married?
Uh-huh.
Who is he to me?
You know him too?
I know him too. I've known him all my life.
No kidding.
Yeah, I'm serious. And look, here's me. It's a teeny tiny baby. With that little smile, right? Around. That's that little smile I do.
Okay.
How's it go? Wait, let me show me. Show me how's it? I like to smile without opening my mouth, right?
Yes. He's a nice little baby.
Isn't that a cute little baby?
Well, don't take a picture when your hair's messed up.
Can you fix it? There we go. Oh, yeah. That's looking good. You getting me?
Trying to get you,
That's good. You're helping me.
Yeah.
There's a footage of your mom with Alzheimer's and a very sort of personal up-close footage, and then also with your dad and your two kids. How did you decide to include that, more private material?
Well, I mean, one of the things that I struggle with a lot is how, in quotes, easy it is for us to ask people we don't know about some of the most terrible things that they have experienced and then to use that footage in films. And I knew, in the case of my mother, that she's a woman who never really wanted to be filmed and very much cared about her own self-presentation in the world. And she would have never, I mean, when she got diagnosed with Alzheimer's, she didn't want anybody to know about it. She wanted to hide it. She would never have wanted footage of her with Alzheimer's to be the footage of her that exists in the world. And so for me, it embodies this idea of betrayal that is deeply complex, right? I mean, I think that footage absolutely shows how much I love my mother and what a loving and gentle relationship existed, and yet it is also absolutely a betrayal of her. You know, the first time I looked at it again, I couldn't believe how much it brought her back to me. And I was like, I was so grateful I had filmed it, even though, like, all of these questions aside, right, and all of the emotion really was in it. And it felt very clear to me that I must use it.
Right. And I guess that the thing that's interesting, another thing that's interesting about the movie is the sense that you could get to the bottom of all these stories if you could stay, but that sometimes there's not enough time. People go away.
And, yeah. I mean, you miss it. You miss it.
Leaving,
you lose
but also
it. Yeah.
People die. And like, there's so much of the film is about places that were horrible, atrocious things occurred, and people got massacred. Like, that's the sort of thing you explicitly show us in the middle of the film, is that whether or not you planned it, you were drawn to places of death and destruction.
Well, I mean, I think one of the things that I've come to realize over time, not necessarily that I'm drawn to death and destruction, but that death and destruction is in the world, and there's invisible evidence of it in many places in the world, sort of like trauma. And, you know, in some ways, the film for me is acknowledging my mother's loss and acknowledging that we all, as human beings, we lose people we love. So we all suffer these sort of
invisible,
fundamental traumas. Yeah, that we carry with us as part of being humans. And the evidence of that in people's bodies, in spaces, I think I became very interested in how I could translate the invisibility of what had transpired.
Making darkness visible, in a sense.
Yeah.
I told her, I have tremendous envy for any documentary filmmaker, because I always feel like, you know, it takes me so long, and maybe you feel the same way as a writer, to like say, you know, he was a withered old man who was picking up a pen with a grimace, and then a, you know, flash of lightning crossed the sky. But meanwhile, and you're doing all this sort of laborious setting up, and in a documentary, it's all there visible within, you know, half a second. Once I got that grievance out of the way, I actually learned there was when we came off the ferry at the 34th Street Pier, she was focusing on a nurse who was taking a nap on a bench.
My peripheral vision thing? Like, I want to know the story of that woman right there. It looks to me like she's a nurse who just got off her shift, probably at Bellevue, that's right around the corner from here, and it's and is sleeping there. So if I walk around, I could confirm that's a nurse's uniform.
Right.
You know.
And she filmed her from afar, and there was a fence in the foreground and a fence in the background behind the nurse. So it actually, in the way she filmed it, it looked like a kind of green fish caught in a net.
But the shot's one thing if you frame it within all of the webbing, right? You have no idea where she is or if she's suspended in something. And then if I shot it wider like that with more context, you understand a little bit more where she is, right?
Excuse us.
Are you sleeping?
Oh, hi. Just taking a nap on my break.
That's what we were just wondering.
Oh,
are you
yeah.
are you a nurse?
Yeah, just break time.
Where do you work?
At NYU.
At NYU.
Yeah,
which department do you work on?
Postpartum.
Postpartum?
Yeah.
Oh, go back to sleep. Don't
no,
let it bother
I just
you.
I just take a time out on my breaks.
Enjoy.
Peaceful.
So
there you go.
There you go.
Mostly confirmed.
Yeah, mostly confirmed.
Except for the Bellevue part.
Right. Yeah,
close.
Postpartum.
Yeah.
Could be depressing, as the case may be.
I was thinking.
Could be joyful too. Yeah.
And you had no idea who this person was. Was it even a person? It was just sort of a symbol. And then she showed, you know, you come around the corner and it begins to make a little bit more sense. And you go in for the close-up and you see the person.
But you saw how suddenly all the different lens lengths changed the story completely.
Right.
And did you see how beautiful she was in the close-up when I got over to here? That told a totally different story than from the other angles.
Turned away.
Yeah.
And showed you how much of any kind of storytelling is where you choose to focus and how you choose to frame things.
And you don't think in writing, too, that's the case?
I totally think that's the case.
Yeah.
I just think how nice to be able to do it, you know, simply by turning your hand a little bit on your shoulder rather than having to gin up paragraphs.
God, we writers are always complaining.
We are. That's what we do.
Tad, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Kirsten Johnson's new film is called Camera Person. She spoke with The New Yorker's Tad Friend.
I'm here with my colleague, Jiang Fan, who for years was a fact checker, and now she's been writing about China and Chinese-American life for us. And as I do every week or every so often, drop in on some colleagues and see what they're reading or listening to. And Jiang, what's on your mind?
So there's a documentary on Amazon Prime on the only Chinese woman to have ruled the Chinese Empire.
What's the documentary called?
It's called Emperor Wu Zetian in Tang Dynasty. And I've been thinking about her a lot recently as we are in our own election season. And clearly, Hillary comes to mind. You know, compared to Wu Zetian, Hillary is really, you know, just a complete saint. This is Wu Zetian. It's rumored to have killed off three of her kids. And this is a story, perhaps not for kids, but to one of her consorts, she chopped off both legs and arms and pickled her in a vat of Chinese wine. And this
I don't think Hillary's done that. Not yet. But if she gets really pissed off.
There might be a possibility.
Yeah.
Even at, you know, in times and cultures as disparate, I think it's helpful to examine how women living in a patriarchal society are subjected to a particular kind of evaluation.
Okay, what's next on your list?
Oh, this one. Okay, so I recently had the occasion to digitalize my cassette collection before they completely disintegrated. And the only existing cassette of myself from childhood was one that my mother made when I was 3. And I spent 45 minutes retelling a single story.
First of all, I got to hear it. I want to hear Jiang at 3. It's amazing you have this.
So the story is an ancient Chinese fable. It's called Mr. Dongguo, Dongguo Xiansheng. and it is available in English translation online. But to give you, you know, the quick and dirty version, it's about a Chinese scholar who is walking in the forest when he comes upon a wolf who's being hunted. The scholar takes pity on the wolf, stuffs the wolf in his book bag. The wolf then tries to eat the scholar. A farmer comes along that saves the scholar and shows him that compassion isn't always the ultimate solution. And this story, I think, has really shaped contemporary Chinese political discourse and thinking. The wolf has often been used as a metaphor for the U.S., for Japan, for the Dalai Lama, as a force that tries to disguise itself as one of benevolence. But the Chinese lesson to themselves is that ultimately they have their own agenda. And if the Chinese do not arm and protect themselves, they will be eaten by the wolf.
Your voice has changed, Jiang.
How's the Chinese?
Yeah. Chinese, excellent. Excellent. Never been better. Jiang, thank you very much.
That was a pleasure.
Staff writer Jiang Fan. You can find everything she's written for The New Yorker at newyorkerradio.org, including a great piece on the children of the ultra-rich Chinese families living the high life in Vancouver. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. Stick around.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from the New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. Last year, The New Yorker published a big story by Michael Pollan on the use of hallucinogens to treat PTSD or the anxiety in terminally ill patients. In fact, there's been a lot of research in recent years about the positive effects of a plant-based concoction called ayahuasca. For anyone who remembers a time when your parents might have told you that those kind of drugs will fry your brain, it's almost hard to believe. So when staff writer Aria Levy pitched me a story about ayahuasca, I said, why not? Ari, you just finished writing this piece on ayahuasca, and better you than me. Tell me about your experience.
You know, one of the things I always try to do when I pitch you a story is emphasize the unpleasant aspects. Like, if I'm doing a story in Italy, I try to talk about how it's going to be hot and grimy and not...
Yeah, I never believe it, though.
Well, so this one was a home run, because I knew I had something really true I could tell you, which was that if I took this drug, I would puke my guts out and possibly experience my own death. That's what people said would happen. So I was prepared for an epic experience because people on ayahuasca report that they're in touch with the essence of pain, and they say that, you know, they see the inside of their own coffins, and it's all just epically horrible. But then when it's over, they, many, many people, and there's neurological science to back this up, that say that the trip mimics the effects of years of meditation, right? So I thought, okay, I'm in.
All right, you spoke to somebody named Dennis McKenna at the University of Minnesota. Tell me about him.
He has been an ayahuasca enthusiast since his 20s when he went with his brother, Terrence McKenna, who's a sort of psychedelic folk hero. They went to Peru in search of ayahuasca, following the footsteps of Timothy Leary, and they found it. And he studied a group of long-term ayahuasca users in Brazil. He did an experiment on 15 guys who'd been using ayahuasca for 10 years or longer to see what effect it had on their brain. McKenna is one of the leading experts on ayahuasca in the world. He's been studying it for 30 years. Dennis, maybe you could tell us about what first got you interested in ayahuasca. Why did you and your brother Terrence go on this quest when you were so young? What attracted you to the medicine?
My brother and I were children of the 60s. We were interested in psychedelic experiences and in their traditional context of use. In 1971, we actually went in search of a different hallucinogen used by the Witoto because we had heard that it was an orally active form of DMT.
We should just tell our listeners that DMT is dimethyltryptamine, which is the psychoactive substance in ayahuasca.
That's right. And DMT by itself is not orally active. It's destroyed by enzymes in the gut. But when you make ayahuasca, you mix it with a different plant that contains inhibitors of those enzymes. So it's rendered orally active, and instead of lasting only about 10 or 15 minutes, it stretches out to about 4 to 6 hours.
And you and Terrence, like so many other members of your generation, were interested in these psychedelic experiences, not as something to do for fun. I mean, you thought you were involved in mind expansion and figuring out sort of the great mysteries of the cosmos. I mean, that was the ethos at the time with these, right?
Yes, among certain groups. And that, you know, back in the day, that was right. We were interested in exploring the limits of consciousness. But as I have worked with ayahuasca over really closer to 45 years, I'm still interested in that. But what's emerged for me as important is its potential therapeutic effects.
In terms of treating what sorts of conditions?
Many possible conditions, such as intractable depression, PTSD, certain kinds of addictions, possibly OCD, all of the symptoms that other people, you know, that the psychedelic research community is investigating for other psychedelics, such as psilocybin.
Gotcha. Now, let's talk for a second, if we could, about the process of hallucinogens sort of falling out of fashion, you know, in the culture, but also in the research community, and then them coming back, our renewed interest in them as a scientific and cultural community.
Well, you know, hallucinogens, particularly LSD, I prefer the term psychedelics, but hallucinogens were very much at the center of the counterculture, the hippies and all this. And it was a time of social turmoil, and there was a lot of alarm, you know, that LSD was, you know, somehow fomenting that. And it dropped into our society like a bomb, and we had no tradition about using these things. The indigenous people did, but our society certainly didn't. So a lot of people became alarmed, and the legislators and, you know, usually misinformed politicians who are usually misinformed about almost everything, you know, decide,
this is
a great threat, you know, and we have to ban it. Well, so they banned it. And that was unfortunate because at the time there was a lot of fairly good work going on with LSD with respect to treating certain things, especially addictions, alcoholism, and that sort of thing. There was a body of work. LSD was very actively investigated. But when they banned it, all of the research pretty well shut down, except non-human research. It was still possible to work with animals and so on. And there was
And then what brought it back? What was the catalyst for bringing it back?
Well, I think partly people, had experiences. They encountered indigenous use of these plant teachers, and they had meaningful experiences themselves. And then, you know, I mean, certainly I would have to credit Terrence because even through this period, he was still talking about it. He refused to stop talking about it.
Right. What I hear from people who are interested in taking ayahuasca is that they think it can treat the human condition, that they think it can help them access a kind of peace with the things that ail all of us, right?
Yes, I would agree with that. I had a friend of mine, close friend, who came a few years ago to my retreat. She had a very rough time. You know, every session she was plunged into the darkness and facing all these demons, you know. And
suffering.
Yeah, suffering. And she said afterwards, that was the most horrible experience of my life. 3 weeks later, she wrote me and she said, that was the best thing that ever happened to me. So there you go.
Ayahuasca is Dickensian, isn't it? It's the best of times. It's the worst of times.
Yeah, it's all about what you do with the experience.
Sure.
You have to go into it with a clear eye, what you expect, why, and realize it won't all be fuzzy bunnies. There will be some rough times. But
sure.
The dark experiences are often, you know, the most useful because you can get deeply into some of these conflicted places.
So, Ari, Dennis McKenna is somebody who's been involved in this research for decades, but there are now ayahuasca circles or ceremonies going on all over the place. It's become an incredible trend. You've even compared it to kale, God forbid. You had an experience with it in New York. I'd love to know more about it.
You know, I was scared because it's you got to pay to play. I mean, the purging, as they call vomiting in plant medicine patois, is the least of it. I mean, I think what people are fearful of is these incredibly intense encounters with the swamp of your soul. So I went to this yoga studio in Brooklyn, and you know, there was all these. It was all women. This yoga studio where we're doing the ayahuasca. It's all very secret because, of course, it's illegal. And I'm ready to rock. And, you know, there's a lot of preparation. You don't eat sugar or salt or meat or alcohol or coffee for 2 weeks in advance. You don't have sex. You clean out. So we're sitting there, and the shaman, Little Owl, starts playing her flutes. And one by one, we go up, and she presents—
I'm sorry, Little Owl is playing a flute?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And then she hands you this Dixie cup, and, you know— I wish it was tea. It's not tea. It's like a cup of mud. It's like a really thick substance that smells—
Is it hot?
No, it's room temp.
What does it taste like?
It tastes like someone has already thrown it up.
God, you're making this better and better. So, okay, so you drink this substance, and how long does it take before you start to feel a little buzz or whatever?
Okay, so very soon thereafter— epic stuff is starting to happen, like very, very quickly. People start barfing. People start crying, you know, at first a little and it's mellow, and then like really epic sobbing. A young woman on the other side of the room starts yelling like at the top of her lungs. And it starts with, I've eaten so many animals. I loved them. And we're all sort of giggling a little, you know, like, oh, that's a little thing that's happening. But it gets weirder and weirder. The one who's up on her feet is yelling and screaming and sex, animals, I want to eat sex.
So at this point, you're not angry at me at any point for sending you to this assignment.
You, David Remnick? I'm not angry at you, David Remnick, but I am
as such
starting to feel a hostility in general towards all this.
To the enterprise.
Mm-hmm. I'm starting to think, oh, Jesus, this is mayhem. It's not working on me. So I'm sitting there, and I'm having these negative thoughts. And then I start thinking, you know what? What am I talking about? This is not a bad experience. This is hilarious. Like,
compared to what? I was at the Bourne movie having a great old time. How good an experience was it?
Well, maybe it was the ayahuasca. Maybe it didn't work on me in the sense of giving me hallucinations and making me see my own death, which in retrospect, you know, I'm kind of okay with.
Right.
Maybe it worked on me by shutting down my default mode network, which is what neurobiologists say ayahuasca does, which is to say it shuts.
What's a default mode network? Explain that.
It's the part of your brain that is firing when you're not focused on a task. And it's the part of your brain you're endeavoring to quiet when you meditate. And experienced meditators are able to do this, and ayahuasca mimics the effect of years of meditation. So the part of your brain that's obsessing about the past, mulling the present, anxious about the future, just adding things up, calculating.
Like thinking.
Yeah.
Like being a sentient being.
No, well, not quite, because the thalamus, which is one of the parts of the brain that governs awareness, is triggering. So Mm-hmm. You're not unconscious, you're aware, but you have an opportunity to have parts of your brain communicate with each other that don't usually get to talk because they're busy doing the default mode network work. That's the theory. So I switched gears then. At that moment, the girl next to me, who's probably 25, says, mm-hmm. help, help. And I am feeling like I have sort of reached enlightenment. So I, of course, say, I'm going to help you. So I just start talking her down. I just say, look, you're not going crazy or on drugs. Focus on your breath. Sit up. You know, da-da-da-da. And Little Owl has started singing, you are the shaman in your life. And I'm thinking, you know what? I am the shaman in my life. And I downright mm-hmm. decent one. I'm calming this girl right down. And she's saying, you know, don't stop talking. Don't let go of my hand. I'm calming her right down. I feel really good. And at the moment, at the sort of peak of my sense of satisfaction with my shamanism, this girl leans over and lets loose the Victoria Falls of vomit all over me. All over me. I am covered in vomit. And this is the interesting ayahuasca moment, right?
Cause, is it?
Yeah, I think so. Because like when you stub your toe, like afterwards there's a second where you wait for the pain and you think, oh, Jesus. As the vomit is pouring over my body, I'm thinking to myself, in a second, I am going to be irate and disgusted. But it never came. I was not irate. I was not disgusted. I was amused. That was my ayahuasca trip.
I used to be disgusted, but now I'm so amused. the end of an ayahuasca trip. Ari, what can I say other than please forgive me?
I do, David. That's how magnanimous this has made me.
Aria Levy, you can find her article, The Drug of Choice for the Age of Kale, at newyorkerradio.org.
I don't understand how anyone says they don't like ants. People start, usually they'll say, oh, ants, really? I'll say, yeah, they do all these different things. They're predators, they ranch aphids, they turn over soil, they do these crazy things with their trails.
We're going to finish up today with a trip to Camden, New Jersey to take a very close look at the ground. On a traffic island in the middle of a wide street, a biologist named Amy Savage is conducting a study of the eating habits of ants in different cities. And this is not just a one-off. When it comes to ants, Amy Savage is in it for the long haul.
We do these outreach events sometimes when we're talking about ants. And I see this pattern where a lot of time the adults are like, oh, I got stung by a fire ant once. So I was mowing my lawn and these ants crawled up my legs. Like, well, yeah, you just destroyed their home. And the kids, though, it's like, I was watching this ant. I dropped some ice cream and it was all over it. And then all his friends were on it. And, you know, it's like so much more of an appreciation for the natural history. So I love being a part of that, and I guess I never lost it as I got older. There's some little ones right here. This might be thief ants. Those are really small. Where? Do you see them?
No.
There's one.
Oh, yeah, they're very small.
Yeah, they're tiny.
Do you meet any people who are confused about what you're doing?
Well, I did have an experience in New Orleans. I was in the French Quarter. And sitting on this upraised root of a big tree. And this guy walked up to me and he was like, that's the spot. The spot? That's where I go when I need to contemplate life. And I was like, okay, cool. I'm studying ants. And so then he told me that I should be aware that they call it neutral ground. That neutral ground was haunted. So I might get visited by a spirit, but they're all friendly. It's okay.
Did you have any spirit interactions while you were down there?
I didn't, but I told them, he asked me what my feelings were on paranormal activity, and I said, I don't have any strong feelings, you know. We have a really intimate relationship with ants, even if we don't think about it very much.
So on the medians, though, their colony is entirely self-enclosed in this dirt.
Multiple colonies, yeah.
So when people walking by see you guys doing the trials and ask sort of what's the point of what you're doing, how do you explain that to them?
So I usually start with saying I'm really interested in understanding how species living in cities interact with their environment and with people. So for ants, if you put these feeding baits out, they will either go crazy for the sugar or they'll really choose the proteins. In street medians on Broadway, over 90% of them went for fats, which wasn't at all what we were expecting. But the same species living in forests and parks in Manhattan went for sugars. So now a big part of what we're doing now is trying to see if this is an urban pattern or if it's something's going on in New York City.
What do you think it is that's going on?
I really think it's being fat starved. I think they're not getting the sources of fat that they need. It's hard living in these urban environments. It's metabolically costly. And so they might be going for the fats because they're expending so much energy just to live in those environments.
So the idea is that they are eating sort of street litter and just things that get dropped, whatever they can sort of get their claws on?
Exactly. So it's really surprising to people because they think human foods are really fatty. But really what gets dropped is really carbohydrate rich more than it is fatty. If you feed ants lots of carbohydrates, then they eat insects more quickly. They're more voracious towards insects.
So these colonies that are living in street medians are, on one hand, essentially living off of human litter, and on the other hand, it's making them more aggressive?
Exactly. Both of those things are happening. And they're not totally living off human trash, but that human trash is kind of this bonanza resource. We definitely see lots of halal food. We see banana peels a lot of times in the medians. You know, Danielle did find a whole rotisserie chicken, but that's not always common.
That's Amy Savage, a biologist at Rutgers University. She met up with the contributor, Alex Karp. And that's about it for this week. Next week on the New Yorker Radio Hour, I'll talk with Jill Soloway, the creator of the great hit show Transparent. I'm David Remnick. Thanks for joining me, and have a great week.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker. Our theme music was composed and performed by Meryl Garbus of Tune Yards, with additional music by Alexis Quadrado. This episode was produced by Emily Botine, Ave Carrillo, Rhiannon Corby, Jill Duboff, Karen Frillman, David Krasnow, Sarah Nix, Michael Rayfield, and Stephen Valentino, with help from Owen Agnew, Emma Allen, Alex Barron, Becky Cooper, Johnny Vince Evans, and Susan Morrison. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported in part by the Chirina Endowment Fund.
Using the phone. Breathing in, I call the operator to report a suspicious voicemail from a person claiming to represent my credit card company. Then I remember that there are no operators anymore, as there is no phone company. Breathing out, I use this moment of agitation to reflect on how everything changes and remind myself of other bygone things I used to complain about but now sort of miss. Rockefeller Republicans, airplane meals, Sonny Bono, Tom Carvel, Times Square when it was nasty, and men who leered at me on the street. On second thought, maybe not Sonny.